Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples. Physicist Dave Rogstad is off today. On today's podcast, who are today's most influential philosophers? We're continuing from last week on philosophy and why it matters. And Ken, now we can look forward to this list. You started to talk about some of them on this list of 50 from academicinfluence.com. Maybe you can kind of give us a little background as to why we're talking about them, how they go about the criteria for ranking, and get right into it.
Well, as I have said many times, I think, Joe, that some people think that philosophy isn't very practical, but I think that that's incorrect. I think that the world in which we live today has been greatly influenced by philosophers and philosophical systems. And so you might think that philosophy is made up of gray-haired old professors at Ivy League institutions, and to some degree you'd be correct. But those ideas move beyond just the category of the college or the university, and they permeate into society. Well, this is a study that was called Academic Influence, and they measure the most influential philosophers in the world. They look at the papers they've written, the influence that they've had. They try to calibrate the influence. And of course, colleges love this because they think, hey, if we have a philosopher, it shows the kind of influence we have. We can invite people to our particular college. There are 50 philosophers mentioned. I think that atheism is top heavy to some degree. But as a point that I made in our previous program is, when you move specifically to the area of philosophy of religion, that is the sub-branch of philosophy that's interested in the God question, then it's top heavy in terms of theists. In fact, the largest subset, Joe, of the American Philosophical Association is the Society of Christian Philosophers. So there has been a renaissance. I mean, if you were studying philosophy 60 years ago, you'd probably, as a Christian, you would not have a lot of professors who were Christian. That's changed today. There is a renaissance. Now, when you look at these 50 names, and I couldn't possibly go through all of them, and some of them I even had to look up and say, who is that? And what is their kind of influence? What I'd like to do is to look at the top 10 and kind of introduce them and describe their influence and talk about it from the standpoint of their interface with God, with Christianity, and with ideas that we find in our culture. Mm-hmm. And again, I want you to be thinking, where do these people come from? And what is their orientation? So let's talk about number one. This is according to this calibration, and again, it could change. If you go on next week, the numbers might go up and down. The names may go up and down. But number one is a philosopher I'll bet a lot of our listeners know, Peter Singer. Mm-hmm. Peter Singer, born 1946, so he's 75 years old. He's getting up there. But Peter Singer is known by many people for his views about ethics. He's a bioethicist at Princeton University. Princeton University was started by the Presbyterians, the conservative Presbyterians. I wonder what a lot of those conservative Presbyterians would think of someone like Peter Singer teaching ethics, right? Mm-hmm. Well, let me tell you a little bit about Peter Singer. He's Jewish. In fact, I think all of his grandparents were killed in the Holocaust, murdered by the Nazis. Peter Singer is very big on animal rights. In fact, he says that if you think human beings are superior to animals, then you're engaging in speciesism. You're giving a privileged place to human beings, and that's wrong. He argues, for example, Joe, that there are other animal species that are more self-conscious at a sooner place in their life. And he argues, for example, that infants, are not as self-aware as some other farm animals. And he has argued, he believes in abortion. He believes in late state abortion. He says fetuses are not rational, nor are they self-aware. He says that parents ought to have 2 years to decide whether they want to euthanize their baby or not.
Wow.
He's an environmentalist. He's a secular utilitarian. So how do you have ethics without God? He would argue you reason to the greatest good for the greatest number of people. Of course, what happens to the minority in that situation? You get with Peter Singer at the head, I don't know. He rejects explicitly the sanctity of life. He says it's wrong. He says it's out of date. It's unscientific. There is no ultimate sanctity of life. Now, I've been kind of critiquing him, and it may sound like I'm beating up on him, but let me also offer this, Joe. I actually think that you probably could credit Peter Singer with really trying to live out his philosophy. That is, he's trying to give you what he thinks is a real secular philosophy of life. He is not Christian. He thinks Christianity is false. His argument against God, there's too much evil in the world. Now, I want to tell you one element here. This kind of came out popularly in the news. Singer, of course, has favored euthanasia. He believes people ought to have the right to kill themselves. He thinks doctors should be able to give drugs for people. And he thinks people who have dementia, that they ought to be at least given the opportunity to commit suicide. Well, what came out in the news is that his mother had dementia. And he admitted that he could not, to use a crude expression, pull the plug. So, sometimes you can advocate a particular view, but when it comes to the people you love, it's very difficult. I think that does tell you that secularism has a real influence in the culture in which we live. America, I think it is fair to say, has always been pretty religious. I think the founding fathers were influenced by the Greeks and the Romans, but also had Judeo-Christian influences. But I think Peter Singer being at the top of the list indicates that we are living at a time where secularism has a big influence. And of course, Peter Singer would say, you don't have the revelation of the Bible. Science can illuminate your path. Mm-hmm. And so he is a bioethicist at Princeton University.
Ken, I wonder if you might comment on this question. He's ranked number one here, obviously. I was reading a while back something about him, and I've read a couple of articles or essays he's written. But when I was poking around trying to find info on him, I saw his long list of accomplishments, his CV, and also that he is years out if you want to get him for a speaking engagement. That's how popular he is. Why do you think that is? Because here I am as a Christian. You're a Christian. Christians are listening to this podcast, and they heard your earlier comments about what he thinks about infants and humans in relation to animals. Is that kind of where we are in our world today, that we want to hear from him? Is he engaging as a speaker? I've never heard him. I've just have read. What do you think about that?
Well, by the way, he has debated some top Christian apologists. He will debate, I'm trying to remember some of the top-notch Christian thinkers that have debated him. Maybe I'll pull that out of my memory here in just a moment. I think the answer to your question is that he is very dynamic. I think that he is kind of giving us a Darwinistic, taking Darwinism and applying it to the world in which we live. Now, he's gotten a lot of hostility and pushback from pro-life groups, the sanctity of life. There are people who are very critical of these ideas. I imagine the answer, though, to your question, Joe, is that there is a deep sense of secularism in our nation and around the world. Remember, he's an Australian. So he's number one. Mm-hmm. That certainly ought to give you a little bit of a pause.
Yeah.
Number two is a big name too. This is Jacques Derrida, spelled D-E-R-R-I-D-A. Derrida is a person you want to know about. He is one of the leading postmodern French thinkers of the 20th century. Passed away just in 2004. Derrida was born in Algeria, French philosopher, best known for his deconstructionism. So let me give a little definition to some of these terms. If you think of Christianity is pre-modern. Pre-modern ideas would be that you can know truth about reality, and God has revealed that truth both in the book of scripture and the book of nature. So you can know objective truth because God has revealed it and he's made you in his image. Then you move to modernism that moves away from religion, away from revelation, and says you can have knowledge through reason, science. Human beings are moving more in a secular direction. Then to postmodernism, where they say, no, you can't really have objective truth. One person described postmodernism as the idea that you really don't know truth, you just have opinions about truth. Mm-hmm. Now, deconstruction, Joe, this will be interesting to you. You're a real word person and editor. Deconstructionism is the idea that that language really can't give you truth. It's equivocal. There isn't a one-to-one correspondence between what a writing says and what it means. And you have to deconstruct it. A lot of times arguments in language have more to do with power and influence than they do with objective truth. Mm-hmm. I think what you can see is that the further away you move from God, from Christianity, from the Bible, then you begin moving in a much more skeptical, subjectivistic approach. And I think Jacques Derrida is one of the most influential philosophers of the 20th century, again, in his kind of postmodern context.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, we talked a bit about him in our previous program, still worth to come back to him, Jürgen Habermas, born in 1929, still living, 92 years old, German philosopher, associated with critical theory, neo-pragmatism. Habermas has argued that how do you guide your life? You guide through a kind of a logical, pragmatic system. He's interacted with Derrida, with Foucault. These are the postmodern thinkers of the 20th century. But since Habermas is German, he also interacted with Joseph Ratzinger. Joseph Ratzinger, of course, became Pope Benedict XVI. We call him Pope Emeritus, right? The Pope that retired. Well, Ratzinger is, in my opinion, Joe, one of the leading Christian, I should put it this way, one of the leading Catholic scholars of the 20th century. Some might even suggest that Ratzinger was one of the brightest popes we've had in hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. you have two very influential popes right there in the 20th century, John Paul II, who is more philosophical, and then you have Benedict XVI, who is more theological. I'm interested in Benedict XVI partly because he is an expert on St. Augustine, and he said that he developed his theology kind of in a dialogue with St. Augustine. He even said something that popes don't often say. Benedict XVI, Ratzinger said, he preferred Augustinianism to Thomism. And that was quite a comment. Well, Ratzinger and Habermas have dialogued with each other. Habermas started off as a real atheist, Marxist, communist, then kind of moved to a period of his life where he just wasn't interested in the question of religion. And then later in life, he has said some remarkable things. As I quoted in the previous program, he has essentially said, Joe, that a lot of the freedoms, a lot of the benefits, the goodness of modern life have come from the Judeo-Christian Bible. That in the Old Testament, Judaism gives you a sense of justice. And in the New Testament, you discover the heart of God, a God who loves us and comes to earth. Well, I didn't know that atheists were supposed to speak that way, but I would place Habermas in the category of a number of leading intellectuals in the world today who may doubt God's existence, who may even say, I'm just not convinced, and therefore remain atheistic. But they believe that Christianity has been good for the world. And Habermas, by the way, is critical of Derrida, Foucault, and their subjective thinking. He says, other than Christianity, he says everything else is postmodern chatter. Hmm. So he's number three, a big name. Hmm. Again, secular in orientation, but also seemingly sympathetic to Christianity. Number four is a philosopher by the name Alistair MacIntyre. Some of our audience might know the name. He is a theist. He is a Christian. He is a Roman Catholic thinker, also born in 1929. He's 92 years old. He converted to Catholicism in his 50s. And interestingly, Joe, he said that how it came about is he was trying to disprove Thomas Aquinas to his students. And he became convinced of Thomas's arguments for God. He calls himself, I kind of like this, he calls himself an Augustinian Thomist. And he says that that's how he approaches the moral philosophy of life. He is a virtue ethicist. Thomas Aquinas believed in what we call virtue ethics. That means that ethics is all about developing moral habits. You develop compassion, you develop courage, you develop honesty. And so life is about developing your virtue. And of course, some Christians have adopted, you know, those kinds of ideas. A couple books that are pretty influential. I mean, Alistair MacIntyre is number four, and he's a thoroughgoing, you know, Christian, a Catholic by affirmation. He wrote a couple books in the late part of the 20th century, Virtue Ethics, and then After Virtue, the first one is entitled After Virtue. The second book was entitled Whose Justice, Which Rationality? And that kind of gets at the idea of, you know, in our world, when people say no justice, no peace, well, whose justice are you talking about? And when you talk about rationality, well, which rationality? Where does it come from? You know, he is a heavy duty philosopher, taught at Notre Dame for many years. And so very solid theist, Christian, Catholic thinker at number four. And it also tells you a little bit about Notre Dame. Notre Dame has had one of the most influential philosophy programs in the United States. Obviously, strongly Catholic, traditional Catholic, and there have been people to come and teach at Notre Dame who are not Catholic, like Alvin Plantinga, for example. So there's a Christian at number four. Mm-hmm. Number five is another philosopher that's known and connected to both pragmatism and to some degree to postmodernism. His name is Richard Rorty, born in 1931, died in 2007. Rorty is, again, a person who has adopted, rejected God, was an atheist, said that life should be lived, society ought to be lived according to pragmatism, utility, progress. You know, I think to some degree, America has been the major promoter of pragmatism. And, you know, if you think of the ancient world, think of the ancient Hebrew world. They thought that learning, the purpose of learning was to devote yourself to God. You know, Yahweh is the beginning of wisdom. The Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Wisdom is found in devoting yourself to God. And so learning things would lead you to be grateful to God for what he has revealed to you. The Greeks, the ancient Greeks, would differ with that. It was a matter of being rational and logical. I think you could say that in modern America, we learn to use. We learn to be practical about things. And I think a lot of people in America have been influenced by that pragmatism, right? Mm-hmm. My dad, you know, why do you want to study philosophy? You know, probably not going to make a lot of money at that. Why don't you do something that's, you know, has a direct application? But, you know, if there is no God, how do you lead your life? Well, you have the sense of pragmatism. Rorty was an American, taught at the University of Chicago, educated at the University of Chicago, Yale University, taught at Princeton University. Rorty, again, an atheist who would be connected to kind of the pragmatism and to the postmodern type of tradition. You can see, I think, that secularism is heavy in this the first few, and postmodernism is heavy. That's why we're seeing the world we have. So when you say philosophy doesn't bake any bread, well, I don't know. It seems like it's influenced the world we live in. Number six is Daniel Dennett. Now, that name should be familiar to you. He's one of the four horsemen of the new atheism. He's a philosopher of science. He's interested in science. He's interested in biology. He is known for attempting to develop a naturalistic explanation of morality and consciousness. Now, that kind of brings us into, I think, some very interesting apologetic questions. I mean, if you don't believe in God, so you believe what? Do you believe the universe is just a brute reality? Is the universe just here and that's all, as Bertrand Russell said in his debate with Frederick Copleston in 1948 on the BBC? So, you know, are you a naturalist? Are you a materialist? Now, some naturalists are not materialists. But of course, the question would be, well, what else is there? If there's no God and we live in the material world, where do you get your ethics? Is it grounded into the universe? Well, my problem is, even if you say that, and there are a lot of atheists these days saying, I believe in objective ethics, but I don't have to believe in God. Well, then where does that objective morality come from? Is it just built into the world? And if it were, wouldn't it be more reasonable that it came from a mind than it was somehow just kind of, you know, placed there in the world? Well, Dan Dennett is one of the Four Horsemen, who says, look, we don't need God. Science can, you know, move us along the path. Again, interested in developing consciousness. I think he probably, you know, if we look at the Four Horsemen, if we look at Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, and Dan Dennett, Dan Dennett probably has the best resume, the best academic resume of the four. He's probably not as articulate, in my opinion, he's not as articulate as Hitchens, or maybe quick-witted as Harris, and probably not as, you know, he's not the picture of atheism that Richard Dawkins is, but he is a very influential philosopher. And by the way, there's a, if you want, go on the web and you type in the Four Horsemen of the New Atheism, there is some interviews where the four of them sit down at a table and they talk about their atheism. They talk about religion. They talk about how they've influenced the world. I think it's, you know, it's about 40 minutes long. I think it's well worth listening to because you get all four of them kind of interacting. So Dan Dennett would be at number six. Mm-hmm. That's pretty high on our list, if you will. Number seven is one of the philosophers I admire very much. It's Alvin Plantinga. He's born in 1932, so he's getting up there. He's 89 years old. He is, of course, a Christian. He a theist, a Christian. Al Plantinga came from a Christian family, Dutch Reformed. And he, his brother, his little brother was the president of Calvin Theological Seminary. His older brother is a well-known musician, pianist, classical musician. His father was a philosopher as well. Well, Alvin Plantinga has a big resume. He has been called, I think by Time Magazine, America's leading Orthodox Protestant philosopher of God. Taught at Calvin College and then went to teach at Notre Dame for many years. He's known for a number of ideas that are quite important in terms of philosophy and theology and apologetics. He's argued, for example, that God is a proper basic belief. That is, you could be, intellectual faculties are working properly, you could be rational in affirming God without evidence. Again, this idea of the sensus divinitatis, that there are certain things like other people have minds or the universe has been here for more than 5 minutes. You believe those things to be rational, but you've never directly observed other people's minds. So he argues that belief in God could be rational without arguments. Now, he thinks there are good arguments, but he thinks religious people could come to believe in God. And of course, he thinks that probably most people who have lived in the world thought that believing in God was just common sense. He is well known for his critique of the problem of evil. He develops what he calls the free will defense, that the reason God has allowed evil is for human beings to make decisions in life, to develop their moral character. He is an advocate of the ontological argument, the modal ontological argument, arguing that God is a maximally perfect being in all possible worlds. So he's engaged in the philosophical issues. And he's known well in philosophy of religion and epistemology. In fact, there's a new school of apologetics called New Reformed Epistemology. He's right as one of the inventors of that system. There are a lot of people that he's influenced. William Lane Craig, I think, says that Alvin Plantinga is one of the most important thinkers that he's kind of modeled himself after. And so I think it's awfully important to recognize that some Joe would say that Alplantica is the greatest living Christian philosopher in the world today. And that he would show up number seven is pretty impressive. It shows you how his ideas have, you know, deeply influenced. I got to hear him speak a couple times, and I've interacted with him through email many years ago. But he's a very gracious man, a mountain climber, by the way, very, very much outdoor, kind of physical kind of guy, and a great sense of humor. All right, well, let me move to number eight on our list, Saul Kripke. Very interesting individual, an American philosopher, logician, analytical philosopher, and Jewish. Now, let me develop this here a little bit. He was born into a Jewish family, and he follows Jewish conviction. And he's probably known as maybe the world's greatest logician. But he doesn't, it's not like Alvin Plantinga, where Plantinga's major philosophical contributions are directly involved in the question of God and religion. Kripke is known for mathematical logic. He's known for, you know, his studies in particular areas of philosophy, but it doesn't come out a lot in terms of his own religious convictions, which I think tells us something, that for a lot of people, Joe, what your deepest beliefs are sometimes private. Not everybody is a public figure. Now, Kripke is a public figure, born in 1940. He's taught at MIT. Again, some people think he is the greatest living logician, which pretty darn impressive to a logic teacher like me. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't make a big deal about his faith. And, you know, he makes comments from time to time, but it's not something that his philosophical areas spill over, but he seems to be a devout Jew. And of course, could I bring up this point, Joe? I kind of look at the question of Christianity a little differently than some of my friends. I think the way that most people become Christians is not at an altar call. I think the way most people become Christians is they're born into a family and the mom and dad are Christians. And they're introduced to God, to Christ, to the Christian faith, to the local church, by their parents. They're often much of the time they're baptized as infants. Certainly true if you're Anglican or Lutheran or Reformed, and you're taught catechism, you're instructed. The same is true for Orthodox Jews. You're born into a Jewish family, you're introduced to the Torah, you're introduced to a Jewish approach to education. I'm really not criticizing the fact that you have revivalism. You know, there are people who do come forth at church gatherings. There are people who go to a Harvest Crusade or go to a Billy Graham Crusade, didn't know the Lord, didn't really have Christian connections in their family. They come forward, they embrace Christ, they go on to love him and serve him. But the point I want to make here is that, you know, sometimes we think that people who are involved in institutionalized religion, maybe Roman Catholic or maybe Anglican or Lutheran, Orthodox, kind of think that, well, you know, that's kind of just traditionalism. I can tell you that in my experience, there are many people who go to high church liturgical churches. And, you know, they're not very charismatic in orientation. They may not talk a lot about their faith, but I've known many of them that are very devout. It's a little more private, but I think that that's true in Judaism as well. And so you know, only God knows the hearts of people. And I try to be very cautious about, you know, making judgments about the spiritual condition of people. I'd rather talk about the truth claims. The subjective side, I think, is something that, you know, should be left to the Holy Spirit and to the Lord in that context. Okay, number nine. Number nine is a man named Hillary Putnam. He passed away in 2016. He was 90 years old. I would say that, again, a lot of the people on this list are getting up there, but that kind of tells you these people have been around a long time. They've written books, they have articles, they have influence, and their ideas, it takes a while for these academicians to have their ideas spill over onto culture. Now, Hillary Putnam is another individual that is a little curious. He's an American philosopher. He's a mathematician. He's a computer scientist, interested in analytical philosophy, the philosophy of language, the philosophy of mathematics, the philosophy of science, has a very, very strong science, we might say STEM, you know, math, science, computer orientation, but he was born into a Jewish family. You know, I think we probably should say that, you know, that he is a philosopher who is an atheist, but again, there's that other side. There is that side. And, you know, Judaism, you can be Orthodox, you can be Reform, not Reformed ED like the Calvinist tradition, but Reform, which is the more liberal, not just politically, but theologically. And then in the middle, there's the conservative Jewish tradition. So, you know, again, let me throw this out there. When you look at Judaism, I mean, it's a tiny religion. It's only 16 million Jews in the world, right around there somewhere. And of course, think of the Holocaust in which 6 million Jews perished. But how influential has this tiny religious tradition been in terms of learning, in terms of academics, in terms of influence in the world? I mean, how many of the greatest scientists have been Jewish? How many of the greatest doctors are Jewish? How many of the greatest attorneys are Jewish? We've talked about a couple of people here in the top 10 who have Jewish backgrounds. Some people have said that the most successful minority in the history of America has been the Jews. Whatever you say about their view of God and their historical connection to the Torah, to the Tanakh, which is the Hebrew for the Old Testament, the Bible, Jews have had a big influence on the world, and they are taught from day one that learning is part of their devotion to God. I think, again, of passages in Job, in Psalms, in Proverbs, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. I think whatever you think about whether they are the chosen people, right, in the Old Testament, Jews have influenced our world in a remarkable way. And I think that Christians have benefited from that. Christians have seen that spiritual focus, that intellectual focus, that sense of God, God's providence. And I think it's important, Joe, for in our world where there is often, you know, we bring up the differences among people, I think it is important to recognize that Christianity has a unique relationship to Judaism. And that, and even people who might be atheists have benefited from the tradition that they were exposed to as Jews. So Putnam fits into that category. Again, recently died in 2016. And that leads us to number 10 on our list. This is a name all of our listeners, I'll bet, will know. It's William Lane Craig. Bill Craig, we've interviewed him on our programs here. I remember interviewing him on Creation Update, or, you know, What Do We Know? One of those programs that goes back a ways. And Dave and Fuzz and Hugh and I and Jeff interviewed him. And of course, Bill was at a conference we had, a remote conference we had about a year ago or so, right before the pandemic. Well, there's a lot we can say about Bill Craig. He's an analytic philosopher. He is a theologian. By the way, there is another study about theologians. Mm-hmm. And on that list, he came in number 3.
Wow.
So he is definitely an influential person. He is an apologist, well known for his Kalam cosmological argument. He's one of the leading defenders of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Those who listen to our program will know that he is an advocate of Molinism. This is a belief that was developed by Luis de Molina, a Catholic thinker, that tries to bring together the mystery of human freedom and God's providence or God's sovereignty. Molinism is, I think, very popular among evangelicals. Ken Keithley, who has been also a very influential person here at RTB, who's been a visiting scholar, who's was part of the RTB Biologos dialogue about creation issues a few years ago. Ken Keithley is a Molinist. And so William Lane Craig is definitely on kind of the Wesleyan Arminian side of these issues. And, you know, I would, I want to say something about William Lane Craig. I don't always agree with Bill. I'm not a Molinist. I am a compatibilist, meaning that I believe that God's providence and human freedom are both true, but I think you need to look at it a little differently than the way Molina did. And of course, I am I'm a Protestant Augustinian. I'm come out of the Reformed tradition, and so I don't always agree with kind of his Wesleyan views. But I have to say, Joe, that I find William Lane Craig just amazingly good at what he does. I think arguably he is probably the finest Christian apologist living in the world today. He is a very skilled debater. He's very sophisticated. I mean, he has a doctoral degree in philosophy and one in theology. I'm impressed by him. I've learned a lot from him. And I think it says a lot that he would make the top 10. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, he is known almost exclusively for his work relating philosophy to Christianity. But I think, you know, I think his debates, he's debated some of the finest secular people in the world. And I've been very encouraged by him. Even this idea, this is something that is very important to me, Joe. I think that Christians need to I think Christians need to be very gracious in coming at the issue of where we disagree with one another. You know, you've had a long history of Christians disagreeing, and sometimes it moves beyond disagreement, to serious friction. I think it's important for Christians in different denominations to be able to respect each other and respectfully disagree. I mean, there are a couple ideas that Craig affirms that I don't agree. And I think they're important issues. But boy, I have learned so much from him. And anything he writes, I will read, because I think his scholarship is just inspirational. So that kind of fills out our top 10.
Ken, just a question, just in case people, again, are wondering, how are these people selected? I think you've been mentioning that this is an academic influence. They're writing papers, publications that are very influential. And I think if I read correctly on this site, Academic Influence, they even employ some kind of artificial intelligence system that takes into account all these factors. So it's not that, you know, somebody's on TV a lot or what have you. That may be the case, but there are criteria that go into this list.
That's exactly right. And Bill Craig, William Lane Craig, has talked about this. He said, boy, you know, when I first became a Christian, I think in high school, he said, I wanted to have an influence on the world. And he says, you know, I'm just flabbergasted and bowled over by, you know, that I would be found to be number 10 on this list, you know, and then number 3 in theology. You know, Joe, I want to say something about that. I mean, you know, Reasons to Believe is an organization, and we're trying to make a difference in the world. We're trying to show that science and faith are compatible. We're trying to show that the Christian worldview is reasonable. You know, it is very important. We write books, we write articles. You know, blogs have become popular these days. You know, the idea of who are you influencing? I mean, you've been around RTB for a very long time, and I have as well, Joe, and I can't tell you how many times I've had people I've talked with on the telephone who said, you know, they're doctors or they're dentists or they're engineers, and they said, you know, I'm a STEM person, math and science have been my love. I had Christian roots, but I couldn't put the puzzle together. I didn't know how can I be a person of science and be a person of faith. Then I read a Hugh Ross book, or I heard a lecture by Fuzz Rana, or I heard a interview with Jeff Swearing. I think that what RTB does is very important. And, you know, sometimes, I don't know about you, but you know, writing books is hard work. Writing articles is taxing. Sometimes you wonder, am I having any kind of influence? But I think what we see is that articles, books, lectures, scholarship, it does have an influence. And I know that it's very tempting to think that, you know, these gray-haired old philosophy professors, you know, maybe they have an influence on the college campus, but they probably don't have much of an influence on culture. I think that's wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think the last couple years of what we have seen in our society reflect philosophical systems like postmodernism. I mean, there is one philosopher, let me introduce you, because the top 10 were all males. In the top 50, there are a number of women. Judith Butler, she's born in 1956, so she's pretty close to my age. She's 65. She is a philosopher of ethics. She is a leading feminist author. She has developed what is known as queer theory, relating to questions of homosexuality. She is herself a lesbian. She's taught at UC Berkeley. She's number 15. Mm-hmm. We see, you know, people having deep influence. And, you know, I remember my sister, my oldest sister, in the late 1970s handing me a book by C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity. I looked at it. I thought it was kind of a funny name. You know, who's C.S. Lewis? Put it on my shelf. But in a few months, I opened it. I started reading it. It became one of the most important books I've ever read. It led to a whole deep interest, not only in Lewis, but in Lewis's arguments and his ideas. And I remember that was the first time I was introduced to the life of the mind. What I mean by that is that I have a responsibility to use my mind to the glory of God. C.S. Lewis was the first one that kind of paved that out. And I remember as a young guy thinking, wow, he's careful. He's thoughtful. I went on to meet other people who influenced me in a similar way, Walter Martin, John Warwick Montgomery, you know, the life of the mind. Well, these are ideas that are important, and it's important to for Christians, you know, not just to be able to hand out tracts to people. I remember when I was a young guy, I read the tract, The Four Spiritual Laws. You know, people engage in different types of evangelism. I noticed just the other day, I'd gone hiking. There's a nature park near where I live, where I hike up the hill. And then I wish I were on Star Trek, where I could get Scotty to beam me back home, where I didn't have to walk down the hill. But I noticed when I was driving back that there were two people at the red light, and they had a sign that says, you know, repent or you're going to burn in hell. And I wanted to talk to them because I wanted to interview them. I wanted to say, well, how effective do you think that approach is? You know, and have you had, what kind of feedback have you had? You know, but I have to say that I think the Lord gives people an opportunity, and you know, scholarship is a very important part of that. And what RTB does, I think, is very important. Mm. And people who read our books, I think hopefully it helps them to have that life of the mind.
Yeah, thanks. Ken, a question along the lines of what you've been talking about here at the end of the podcast. Let's say there's somebody listening and they, you know, we've gone through the pandemic, which doesn't seem to end. They've been rethinking everything, and perhaps thinking maybe I ought to study some philosophy, or they have children in their home who are very sharp and they want to direct them, and they like philosophy in addition to apologetics and theology and all that. How would you advise somebody like that? You mentioned reading C.S. Lewis, but what would be kind of a path for people to start doing, start reading or start asking questions or what? How would you advise somebody in that position?
Yeah, I think we have a lot of people like that. I mean, Joe, we have a lot of people who are parents who with young kids, and a lot of them are dissatisfied with the public schools. So they're thinking about charter school or private school or homeschooling. You know, I think exposing your kids to ideas is very, very important. You know, I all of my kids are adults now. My daughter Sarah, her birthday's today. We over the weekend we celebrated her birthday, and I gave her two books. You know, and I remember a couple of years ago she said, "Dad, I want to expand my library." I thought, that's my girl, you know. But I gave her a couple books. And I think that teaching our people to think critically and carefully is important. It's not just for adults. It's also to help people. Yeah, I think there's some really good books out there and good material. If I could mention a couple of my own books, I think a book that would be very helpful when it comes to philosophy, when it comes to worldview, when it comes to kind of a Christian philosophical orientation, a book I wrote entitled The World of Difference will give you, I think, I hope both a substantive and yet accessible introduction to what Christian philosophy would be all about. Has chapters on logic,
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.